From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's probably fair to say there were two different audiences listening to the announcement and news conference yesterday for the new leadership of the LDS Church. Rank-and-file members heard the religious language, references to tradition and commandments and principles. Others were looking for something else, signs that may indicate what this new presidency is going to mean for the issues Mormons, like all religions, face in the future. How you get and retain members, how you stick to core principles but adapt to younger generations and shifting sensibilities. As one of our guests on the show today put it, the next few years are going to be marked by the church and its members coming to terms with its doctrine, but also its public perception. Today in the program, what to expect from this new leadership and what Mormons themselves are hoping for. Join us after the news.
On the next More to Say, the story of Madison Jensen.
She was the one that whatever Dad wanted to do, she was in your back pocket. Whenever we would go duck hunting, fishing, she was going.
Madison died in a Utah jail. In fact, more inmates die in Utah jails than any other state. KUER's Whitney Evans has been trying to find out why. Download the story now, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the days after LDS Church President Thomas Monson died, the New York Times religion reporter Laurie Goodstein was explaining what to expect next. She wrote that Mormons don't do succession drama, that when the head of their church dies, the next leader is chosen from the ranks, which is a system, she said, that is intended to avoid instability or intrigue. Russell M. Nelson, the man chosen to take Monson's place, said pretty much the same thing yesterday in remarks televised to members throughout the world. He said the man called to be president is no mystery, that there is no electioneering, no campaigning. But Goodstein and Nelson were only partially right. While everyone expected Nelson to be the next president, it did seem dramatic that Nelson changed the counselors in his first presidency. Gone is the immensely popular Dieter Uchtdorf, who was replaced by a man who's been Nelson's confidant for many years, Dallin Oaks. And in some ways, Nelson just settled things back into seniority, but observers are wondering if this might mean something more, like a shift in tone, away from grace and unconditional love toward rules and principles. Well, today in the program, we're talking about what to expect from this new Mormon leadership. And here's what we're hoping to learn from you. What do Latter-day Saints, those of you who are, what do you want from your new leader? What are your expectations and hopes for Russell Nelson as he takes the helm of this global church? 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us here in the studio is Lee Hale, who is, of course, KUER's religion and education reporter. He was at the press conference and that announcement yesterday. He's joining us here in the studio. Welcome back.
Hey, Doug.
Joanna Brooks is also going to be with us throughout the hour. She's a scholar of American culture and religion, a professor of English at San Diego State University. She's the editor of the forthcoming book, Decolonizing Mormonism. She's also the chair of the foundation behind Dialogue, a journal of Mormon thought. And she's joining us from a studio in San Diego. And Joanna Brooks, welcome back to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And Janon Graham Russell is also going to be with us throughout the hour, a PhD candidate at Harvard University. Her research focuses on how racial identity informs a religious practice in Mormonism. She's joining us from the studios of the on the Harvard campus there in Boston. And Janon Graham Russell, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Good morning.
Okay, I guess I wanted to begin. Lee, let me just put it to you.
Yeah.
What general impressions from yesterday? Just the announcement, what you saw, what did you expect, what surprised you a bit? Just quick general impression, I guess.
It is interesting that the president of the church's first experience is kind of something that you don't see a lot, which is a press conference, right?
Yeah.
From my impression, it seemed that Nelson, Oaks, Eyring, they were really comfortable with each other. There was kind of like this Nelson didn't seem nervous. He seemed open to questions. I don't think he was particularly good at answering the questions presented him.
Well, it's almost like it. I have to say, it almost seemed as though he wasn't expecting difficult questions. That he didn't get that his audience wasn't just faithful Latter-day Saints.
He was speaking to faithful Latter-day Saints.
Yeah.
And the questions were from media, so it felt a little bit like, well, are you answering the question, or are you kind of, who are you speaking to, right? And it makes sense, as the president of the church, he's speaking to members, but, you know, there's a question about LGBT members, and he didn't mention, he didn't say LGBT, he didn't say gay, he talked about God's love for all his children, and it kind of felt like, well, are you going to at least address the fact that they're LGBT Mormons?
Yeah.
And then you kind of saw Oaks kind of leaning over on his right-hand side, kind of reiterating some of the comments, kind of jumping in.
Jumping in.
Which was an interesting dynamic.
Was that remarkable?
That seemed unique to me.
Yeah.
And it makes sense. You know, they were called the same year, 1984, to be apostles. So they know each other very well.
Yeah.
They haven't, neither of them have been in the first presidency before. There is a familiarity, but it seemed like almost like, okay, so this is kind of be a thing where they kind of hand off to each other. Oaks seemed very protective of Nelson. He wanted to make sure that people were hearing what he wanted, you know, what he wanted them to hear.
Reiterating that he was young and vibrant and that he skied and that
I mean, Oaks raised his voice and said, don't underestimate him, right? Like he might look, he's 93 years old, but he's young at heart.
Joanna Brooks, what did you see yesterday?
How are they going to get people to watch conference? Uchtdorf is such a tough act to follow, and Monson's warmth and folksiness. No, but seriously, retention. And the question I had on my mind as I watched it is, how will they keep the multi-generational membership in the U.S. Loyal and engaged, because that multi-generational U.S. membership is critical to funding the continuing growth of the church around the world.
But Joanna, they didn't say anything like that. They didn't even address that as if it was an issue. They didn't really address any what they saw as challenges.
Exactly, which is why that's the question. I think that's the headline. You know, the church has the church aspires to growth, has always aspired to growth.
Yeah.
It is encountering a serious slowdown in growth, flatlining in the U.S. Areas of growth like Africa require investment that is depending now on maintaining the loyalty of members in the United States. And that's the challenge they've got ahead of them. And you're right. And that question was not openly addressed yesterday. The strategy seems to be not the public relations agility of President Hinckley, not the warmth and, you know, let's hug it out through the doctrinal challenges like LGBT, women's ordination of Monson and Uchtdorf, but batten down the hatches, close the ranks.
Janon, what did you hear?
Well, two things. I did notice when Oaks was always chiming in when President Nelson spoke, and it felt to me that we were preparing for President Oaks, prophet of the church. I think he's going to have a very strong presence in the next few years as President Nelson leads the church. Another thing I also saw is that they were very strategic, especially in regards to their comments on women, the LGBTQ community, as well as people of color. For me, for that conference was them essentially firmly rooting themselves in a conservative base. I think after the New York Times opinion piece on President Monson, you had this struggle between Mormon identity. You know, how do Mormons see themselves versus Mormon identification and how others perceive themselves? And I think yesterday's conference was really a solidification of the church saying this is who we are and this is who we're going to be moving forward.
Lee, maybe we should explain for those who aren't aware, because this was for some reason, I shouldn't say for some reason, I get why it was, but it was a big deal, this New York Times obituary of Thomas Monson. There was this big petition and people thought it wasn't reverent enough, wasn't respectful enough, focused too much on the controversy.
Like a lot of things these days, I think it had more to do with the tweet than the actual article.
Yeah.
And the tweet emphasized that Monson didn't speak to LGBT issues and women's ordination. So it was basically a tweet about what he didn't do with a link to the obituary. And the obituary was pretty dense and kind of almost clinical, right, about this man who's so beloved to Mormons. And so you did find a lot of Mormons on social media seemed pretty incensed that this was their beloved prophet and that somebody would kind of write this article in this with this tone. I mean, there was this clash, too, that people – sometimes Mormons have a hard time seeing how they're seen from the outside, right? That not everyone knows Monson as a storyteller, or not everyone knew him for his visits to widows, but people saw there were some issues on the national stage, and they did not see a Mormon prophet addressing them.
Janan, you say we haven't heard the last of that. You think we're going to hear more of these references to that kind of thing, and I'm wondering what you mean.
Specifically in terms of Mormon identity?
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, when Peggy Fletcher Stack stood up and asked the question regarding women's participation as well as people of color, they gave a very strong, almost a traditional answer. There was no ambiguity. And so I think going forward, I'm talking about Mormon identity, it's going to be very straightforward, leaving very little to question.
I wanted to ask about what we know about Russell Nelson. Joanna, let me start with you. So he's a heart surgeon. Didn't have a whole lot of – I mean, he probably had plenty of callings, I suppose. But his acclaim came with his career as a very good and very well-respected heart surgeon. So what do we know about him, his sensibility, his sort of ministry that you could be expecting now?
I just want to echo what Janan said about, you know, President Nelson's presentation yesterday, demonstrating a sensibility of rooting down in the conservative base. I'd characterize him as hawkish, which is an unusual personality for someone who's in the prophetic role to have, unusual to the last few decades. We know that he is used to working in difficult, contested circumstances. He trained surgeons in China. He's fluent in Mandarin. He was over the Eastern Bloc during the Soviet era as an apostle. He has been in the 12 for 34 years now. We know that he's been bold in the context of the Quorum of the 12. We know that he's been tough. He is understood as the architect and driving force behind the November 2015 policy forbidding baptism of children of LGBT members. He is not averse to conflict or confrontation. And he, as you indicated, has a very close ally in Oaks, who we know has been preoccupied and, in fact, tasked by the 12 with preparing legal briefs on threats of gay marriage since 1984. So I believe that together we will see them both, as Janan said, rooting down in a conservative base and creating and continuing to create an environment where doctrinally conservative and doctrinally orthodox members feel affirmed in continuing with the most orthodox interpretations of Mormon scripture and theology.
He doesn't seem to have the warmth isn't exactly a word I think that comes off when you listen to a speech or an address by Russell Nelson. Is that right, Lee?
You hear about warmth, that's personal interactions. But yeah, but when he's speaking, it seems like he just is telling you the basics, right? This is what Mormons believe. This is kind of like a return to basics with his, you know, his eloquence is not the priority. It's kind of exactness with him. I will say the thing that I think will be possibly a strength for him as the leader of the church is that he had a lot of validation before he had his time serving in the church full time. He had plenty of validation through his career. He doesn't strike me as somebody who is, he seems confident. Yeah. He seems that he's comfortable in his own skin. One thing that was unique about the press conference is, you know, typically it's very obvious you're talking to the president of the church. He didn't mind sharing the time with the counselors.
Wasn't hogging the mic.
He doesn't seem like he wants – he's hungry for the spotlight. So it makes me wonder, is this going to be a president who is more willing to kind of set his apostles free a little bit to also be kind of spokespeople for the church? Is he going to give them a little more autonomy? And maybe, you know, with Monson, since he was such a quiet prophet and because he wasn't doing well for so long, it kind of felt like a lockdown a little bit. Like you weren't going to hear that much from any church leaders because you weren't hearing from him. Whereas Nelson, just the vibe in the room at the press conference, it seemed like he wasn't worried. He was kind of that after the press conference ended, the apostles kind of milled around a little bit and they weren't afraid of mixing with members of the media. And it just felt a little like just he was fine. He was and you know, maybe he was a little tone deaf, but he was comfortable up there.
Let's take a call because I want to get to this change in the first presidency and the counselors, which I think a lot of people are seeing is pretty significant. Let's take a call from Yvonne, who's with us in Salt Lake City. Yvonne, welcome.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
So I was raised in the church, and through my adult life, I've been active and inactive, but now I have a daughter that's bisexual, and the exclusion policy was really hard to swallow. It's hard to think that, you know, as the LDS religion says, is that God is an all-loving God and loves and accepts everyone, but now not the gay community. And so in 1984, Elder Oaks wrote this paper about the church's stand on all this on the LGBT community, and it's quite harsh. I read it again last night, and I was in tears. It's frustrating, but Uchtdorf was so, I don't know if accepting is the right word, but he was all about love and inclusion, and we love our LGBT friends and members, and to see him released from that position is such a disappointment. And I know among the community, it's such a disappointment. And I don't know if outrage is the right word, but it's because watching that news conference, it was very clear that spirit of inclusion is now gone.
Sorry, go ahead.
That's okay. I'm done.
All right, stay with us. Joanna Brooks and Janon Graham-Russell, I want to hear you on this. Joanna, you first. What is the significance of removing Dieter Uchtdorf? Has he been chastised or just placed back in the ranks? I mean, and what is the significance of that? Because I think, as you're hearing from Yvonne, there's a lot of disappointment because of it.
Well, Yvonne's comments brought to mind something that LaShawn Williams, who's a professor at Utah Valley University, said in the Salt Lake Tribune a couple days ago, is that the church stands at the, you know, church has operated at the crossroads of history and hope. And hope took a major blow with losing Dieter Uchtdorf. His voice calmed and assured us that we could walk through what felt like massive contradictions in our own theology and policy. How a church that proclaims to follow Jesus Christ could forbid the baptism of innocent children was a blow, just a blow. I have heard more anecdotal stories of deeply conservative LDS people in their 70s and 80s whispering to their gay grown children, you know, that wasn't really from the Lord. When we were willing to abide those contradictions and walk through them, if, as Yvonne said, we had a voice, like LaShawn Williams said, Dr. Williams said, that could give us that hope that there was something at the core of our faith still that was good and benevolent and merciful. So it's hard. I don't know if there's a punishment message involved. I think that the close, you know, the confidant status of Oaks and Nelson, they were sustained the same day, can't be underestimated. Yeah, and their joint efforts on creating batten down the hatches policies, like the Family Proclamation, which should be understood as a legal defense of Mormon doctrine, and the November 2015 policy, which will play the same role.
Janon, what do you think about how did you react to the Uchtdorf part of this story?
I was actually quite saddened by the news. Uchtdorf, actually, I converted about 8 years ago, and Uchtdorf has been someone that I've really admired. I haven't always agreed with, but I feel a sense of hope when he does speak about his own life and the gospel. Specifically, recently when he was talking about his own immigrant experience and how I felt that a lot of members who were going through similar things could relate to that. And so to echo Joanna's words, that there was a sense of loss of hope, specifically among progressive Mormons.
Let me read a comment. This comes from Tom. Tom writes, I'm an active member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and something that really bothers me is the church's deathly silence on two issues of importance to me. The first is climate change, and Joanna Brooks, you've had something to say about that, so we're going to get back to that in a moment. I think that's really interesting. The second issue for Tom, though, is silence, as he puts it. Why don't our leaders speak out against our current national leadership, especially Donald Trump? It's extremely embarrassing to me to read, Tom writes in the Tribune, that 61% of Mormons support Donald Trump. Joanna Brooks, what do you make of that? This gets us, I guess, to I wonder if Mormons feel in an awkward position now trying to cultivate this global membership, and you have the president saying allegedly some incredibly hurtful things about people from African countries wanting to emigrate into the United States. How do you respond to that?
Well, certainly. We grew as an American church globally in a time, scholarship on conversion in South America and Latin America has suggested that there were some distinctly middle-class aspirations that drove a lot of converts' interest in this North American church. The Trump era, especially as we look to Africa as the source of the most rapid growth right now, calls some of that into question. Will there be that same sort of aspirational gaze towards the U.S.? But, specifically, I really identify with what Lee said about the sort of the confidence of President Nelson. He's clinical, right? He's a surgeon.
Literally.
There was a sense of imperviousness to change, of invulnerability, that things are the way they are now in the church because that's how God intended them. Just sort of an indifference to context. And we are in a time when change and changing context will matter tremendously to the spiritual lives of rank and file people. The caller mentioned climate change. Look, we're looking to regions of the globe like Africa, like even Southeast Asia, where missions have recently been opened in Vietnam, that are incredibly vulnerable to climate instability, to drought, increased disease, lack, loss of livelihood. We have substantial membership in the South Pacific, and island nations in the South Pacific are facing massive threats to livelihood, health, and existence due to global warming. Will we say that things are the way God intended them to be? How will we respond to members who are experiencing catastrophes of displacement and loss of livelihood during this time? Mormonism has been, its theological strength has been assuring people that no matter how difficult life on this earth is, in the eternities, all will be well. We will have our families. That's a powerful message, but will people be able to hear us given what we face in the coming years?
I will say it is a sign of pride as far as politics go that the church doesn't weigh in on specific politicians. I mean, the church does its lobbying, especially in the state of Utah, but there's very little overt political kind of, weighing in on issues. Something like climate change, maybe this listener's thinking more in the lines of, Nelson talked about humanitarian efforts, right? About just the need for being in tune with the needs of third world countries where the church was represented. He seems like that was a big focus for him. I wonder what that will take. Is it just going to be the typical relief effort, or is it going to be a more focused awareness on what those members are actually going through?
I wanted to get back to this question of diversity, I guess. It's one of the questions that was put to them. Peggy very cleverly combined two questions related to diversity and women.
She just got the one question.
She just got the one, but then she had to jump in off mic, which was quite great,
and
which I will play in a moment. Here is Russell M. Nelson's response to this question of whether or not there's going to be any kind of diversity in the upper ranks of leadership, something beyond other than just white men from the United States of America, and in many cases, or most cases, the Wasatch Front of Utah. Here's his response, and I just want to play this and get some reaction from those of you here.
We are white. And we are American. But look at our quorums of the 70. And look at our leaders locally. Wherever we go, the leadership of the church is from the local communities. And those are the real leaders. The 12 and the 70 are not a representative assembly of any kind. That means we don't have representatives. How would you govern a church with a representative from all of the 188 countries? So somebody's going to be left out, but it doesn't matter because the Lord's in charge, and we'll live to see the day when there'll be other flavors in the mix. We respond because we've been called by the Lord. Not one of us asked to be here.
Okay, so two things there. Giannana, I want to hear from you on this. One of the things he said was, look, we've got local leaders. There are people of color with local leaders and in the lower ranks of the echelons of Mormonism. And then also, this is God's will. It doesn't matter because this is God's will. We didn't ask for this. God apparently wants just white people right now on the leadership. How do you react to that?
So lots of opinions on that. I think, and specifically looking at Africa, where there's a semblance of autonomy, you look at the local leadership there and you do see more leadership coming from the area. But then when you look at the area authorities, I was just looking at it last night, and if you look at Africa Southeast as well as Africa West, it's all white men. And so this idea that the Lord is only choosing white men, or it's God's will that white men are chosen to these positions of authority, is quite problematic, right? Specifically in terms of the priesthood and temple restrictions and trying to move on or trying to build bridges, it doesn't send a very positive signal to people of color and international communities that this church is for them as well.
I guess, Joanna, it also raises the question of there are two vacancies now in the 12. What to expect if you have a traditionalist, a conservative who is hunkering down, staying with the status quo? What would be the expectation of these two new potential apostles?
Right. And I just want to, you know, underscore what Janan said about the communication from President Nelson being that, well, we're white because it's God's will. We're here. We didn't ask to be here. And what you see is a reflection of what God intends, and how deeply troubling that is, just in terms of its imperviousness to a sense of our own history as LDS people, which is a history of purposeful anti-black segregation. Painful to say, but absolutely true. Segregation of our temples, segregation of our priesthood. So without that sense of even responsibility for our own moral shortcomings in our history, that's hard. And no one's done that heavy lifting at the top. No one has, you know, said, and, you know, Janan referred to this important year in terms of the abolition in 1978. This is an anniversary year for the abolition of the ban on priesthood and temple attendance by black people. And we still haven't had from the top an apology. We haven't had from the top a full moral reckoning with what that has meant. And I don't see any sign that that will change. And unless we're willing to take responsibility for our history, how can we expect ourselves to keep up with, you know, understand the will of the Lord as it unfolds in our current historical growth and bring in new folks? We don't have a change mentality that's now at the top. So I don't expect that new calls to the 12 would reflect that appetite for change.
I think it's important too. I think talking about Uchtdorf earlier, kind of some of the strengths that have been mentioned already, he validated, right? I think there's some people who talk about policy changes needed in the church. I think a lot could be done with just simply acknowledging specifics, right? Talking to the marginalized members, people who feel a little left out. Uchtdorf did that, sometimes in a subtle way, but people, I think Uchtdorf single-handedly, with the words that he shared during General Conference addresses, probably kept people in the church because they felt heard and they felt validated by what he said. And yesterday there wasn't a lot of validation going on.
It's you hear a lot of references or comparisons between Dieter Uchtdorf and Pope Francis.
Right.
Right? I mean, that Francis is not changing doctrine within Catholicism, but speaking differently.
Tone.
In a different tone.
And yeah. And you think about these men are revered so deeply. Even if you're somebody a Mormon who feels a little jaded, I think that there still is a reverence maybe in the back of your head for what they have to say and what they stand for. And so to have somebody like Uchtdorf, you know, I'm reminded of one of the quotes he shared, you know, don't judge me because I sin differently than you. Acknowledging that everyone sins, you know, him being a spokesperson for the church as a member of the First Presidency, when he talked about his imperfections, it felt like he actually meant it. There seems to be kind of like this house voice from the church, which is, we don't apologize. There's very little humility. He seemed humble.
Well, he said we make mistakes at one point.
Right. And you got a hint of that yesterday a little bit with Oakes and Nelson saying, give leaders a little leeway and they'll give you a little leeway with your mistakes, which felt a little bit new to me. And maybe a little spark of hope if there wasn't a lot of hope in that press conference. But just the idea of we don't apologize, like Joanna was saying, we don't apologize for these things that have clearly caused pain. I mean, I wonder, I don't know if these are the guys to change that tone, but Uchtdorf was definitely somebody who had kind of grasped that to a degree.
Here's a comment from Kristen, who writes, Elder Uchtdorf was the only apostle with worldwide appeal. Not having him in the first presidency will be seen outside of Utah as a demotion of sorts and a huge step backwards in terms of a worldwide viewpoint. Kristen writes, I foresee more people stepping away from the organization, an organization that seems to be more backwards facing than forward thinking.
I think it's important to say that being a member of the Quorum of the Twelve is not nothing, though. You know, yeah, there might be a demotion to a degree, but you think about some apostles can do a ton as far as just in tone. They still speak at General Conference. You think about someone like Elder Holland, Jeffrey Holland, who, you know, is somebody who everyone kind of sits up in their chair when he gets up to speak. And so I foresee Uchtdorf still having a ton of influence as an apostle, not as much airtime, but a ton of influence.
Let me take one more call before we head to a break. Greg is with us in Salt Lake City. Greg, welcome.
Hi, Doug. Thanks for taking my call. I was a Mormon missionary back in 1987. I know that was an age ago. What was it, 31 years ago? And I was in a small intimate meeting with who would have then been a 61-year-old Elder Nielsen. And I remember just so clearly him saying two things. One was that we're excommunicating too many people. And two, that we need to, and he used this word, this is kind of paraphrasing what he said, that homosexuals are children of God and they should be treated as such. I thought I was in the wrong church. Because back then, I mean, it was very, I mean, I just thought that was just eye-opening for me as a young missionary. And then just recently when I heard that Elder Nielsen talking about that this policy of exclusion of children of homosexual members or gay members as being the will of the Lord, contradiction city. I mean, I know that things can change in 31 years, but I don't know what to believe. And I don't know, you know, as far as where the church is heading, it just seems like yesterday's news conference and today's, from what I've heard today, is that they're just kind of turning their back.
I want to play a moment. Greg, thanks very much, by the way, because that leads to a moment from yesterday's news conference that I found interesting. This kind of this kind of balance between love and commandment. And this came between Nielsen and Lee, as you mentioned, Dallin Oaks, who seemed happy to jump in. Here's what President Nielsen said. This was in response to the question about how to deal with this LGBT question and LGBT members.
God loves his children, and he wants them to have joy. We know that there are challenges with the commandments of God, challenges to be worthy to enter his holy presence when we're through with this mortal experience. And we're trying to help people find happiness and joy in this life and prepare for their great possibilities in the world.
So he kind of goes on and about this, but it was about love, right?
I think they said love and law.
Well, but that's the thing. So then Elder Oaks comes in, and this is the part that I think was interesting.
At the same time, because of God's love for his children, he has given us commandments. He's given us a plan to achieve the highest blessings he has for his children. And as leaders of the church, we have the responsibility to teach love and also to teach the commandments of God and the high destination that he has prescribed for his children, all of which is embodied in the plan of salvation.
So, Joanna, what I was hearing there was, I don't think it would be fair to say that was a kind of rebuke of the president saying, you're spending too much time talking about love. Let's get back to the idea of commandments. But that did seem an interesting contrast. I'm wondering if you noticed that.
What I heard was, again, a doubling down on the doctrine of eternal marriage as being the gateway to exaltation. That is, as you know, Jan pointed out, this is a time when we're going to see, you know, the resurgent rooting down in that core conservatism. And that's a conservative message. We love everyone, and God expresses his love through law, and there is a straight a narrow path and there is a narrow gate, and that gate is heterosexual marriage in a temple of the Lord. And again, I wonder, just again thinking about how these issues of gender and sexuality intersect with issues of people of color and also global growth, what will that marriage message sound like in so many areas of the globe where women are seeking out the church, like Africa, and where women are maybe heads of household, where women may not have the same concept of family as the sort of nuclear family, middle class American model? What will this mean if this is the message, if this is the hill we're going to plant the flag on doctrinally, as being so important?
In addition to that, part of that marriage discussion was in response to a question about millennials. You know, the question was raised that millennials are less religious.
That was such an interesting answer. So people were asking, what are you going to do with millennials? Because they have a different disposition and they think differently. And the answer was, they should get married.
And that was kind of Oaks who brought up, I think, marriage. And they all kind of nodded their heads. But it was just kind of – that was another moment where it's potential for validation, right? Which is that there's these 20-somethings and 30-somethings in the church that don't quite fit right now into the nuclear Mormon family. And you kind of double down on, well, they probably would fit better if they're married. And it's like, well, I think they know that. I think they get the picture. And so in that sense, it felt a little bit like, well, is this just kind of this grandfatherly role they can't shake, that, you know, you ought to get married and you ought to have kids? It just seemed a little odd.
Well, there's statistical research too. Jana Reese's recent research on millennials in the church shows that, and on doubters as well, shows that people who do marry in and stay in these multi-generational communities do have higher retention rates. So they probably have those statistics too.
They probably love those statistics.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess that's the – well, let me take a break, and because I want to come back to this idea, whether there's a strategy here of just really cultivating those that are in, the Orthodox, and maybe leaving behind those who might be on the fringe. This is something that people are wondering about. We have Lee Hale with us, KUER's religion reporter. Joanna Brooks is editor of the forthcoming book, Decolonizing Mormonism. Janon Graham Russell is a PhD candidate at Harvard University, a contributor to the books Mormon Feminism and A Book of Mormons. We'll take a break and come back in just a moment. Let me just give you the number again. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@KUER.org. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're rounding out our coverage of the LDS Church for the moment because, of course, there's been a lot going on in the faith. They lost a longtime leader, Thomas S. Monson, and now we know who is replacing him. It's Russell M. Nelson, has been ordained as the 17th president of the church. So we're talking about what Mormons can expect from this new leadership. Joanna Brooks is a scholar of American culture and religion, joining us today from San Diego. We have Lee Hale with us. He's KUER's religion reporter. And in Boston, we have Janon Graham Russell, who's a PhD candidate at Harvard University. Her research focuses on how racial identity informs religious practice in Mormonism. And again, you can join us, 801-585-WEST. That's the number. Okay, so let me – I want to play – there was this moment I thought was interesting – where Dallin Oaks is speaking here, and then Peggy, she's off mic at this point because she, you know, she asked her question, and you can hear it, and she's trying to reiterate the question, "What about women?" which is exactly how she puts it. But let me play this exchange, and then the response, or part of the response anyway, from President Nelson. We'll hear from Dallin Oaks here first.
We are better suited to relate to one another and to avoid a kind of quota system, as if God applied his blessings and extended his goodness and his love on the basis of quotas that I think he does not recognize, so we shouldn't.
But what about women?
I love them. I have a special place in my heart about the women. I'm the father of 9 beautiful daughters. And I often wondered, how am I so lucky as to get girls? Where are all the missionary boys? Well, we finally did.
Okay, Lee, what do you think about that as an answer? That wasn't one of his better moments. It just did really seem tone deaf to, I think, to a lot of people.
It did, but it also probably felt familiar to a lot of Mormons. Right. I think Mormons are used to this idea of the question of women's influence and then kind of have this worshipful reverence. Well, Well, I have daughters. I have a mother, as if that makes you an expert. And it seems strange. You know, if I were to give him a little debrief after the press conference, I would say probably don't refer to diversity in the church as flavors in the mix, and don't talk about that worshipful reverence for women when clearly Peggy was asking about leadership.
Yeah.
You know, why? I mean, decision making. I don't even think she said leadership. She said, how do you include women in decision making? And then to say, well, look at the wonderful influence they already. That's not decision making. And I think that was just a moment where it felt like, well, we're not going to get quite the answer to that.
Joanna, I've got to hear from you and Janan on this one. This putting women on a pedestal almost is what it sounded like. Pretty typical.
Well, and don't forget that Peggy's first question was not just about women. It was about people of color. And I really want to hear Janan talk on this one, too.
Yes. So, I mean, specifically on other flavors, it reminds me of, there's a quote from Robert F. Kennedy a couple years ago when he talks about black people in positions of leadership, and specifically looking towards the future that one day, you know, in a couple decades, that people of color, a black person, may become president. And I feel like President Oakes's comments specifically point to that idea that, or specifically, I'm sorry, President Nelson speaking about other flavors, and that, you know, eventually it will happen. But it's fascinating because kind of going back to what I was saying before about, this idea that it's God's will that only white men are called to these leadership positions. And so you get this normative idea that, you know, that it's white men, whiteness, that's going to be occupying these roles. But so when you have that inclusion of other people, whether it's women, of people of color, women of color, it's going to seem like a quota. Whereas all it is wanting to see yourself represented at the table. And so I found those comments to be very problematic. And I hope that there's some clarification on what was said yesterday. But we'll see what happens.
Joanna, do you want to say anything more about Nelson's response just related to women? Again, what Lee said, I think, is important. Peggy was talking about what will the role potentially be for including women more in the decision-making process.
Well, it's just hard to get past, you know, as a woman who actually works in the outside world, it's hard to get past how Peggy Fletcher Stack, this esteemed journalist who does have a decades-long track record of professional reporting on LDS Church matters, was patronized by President Nelson. I mean, I know he meant it in the best grandfatherly sense, but again, as Lee indicated, it was not clear that they understood they were talking to the world at the same time as they were talking to this small cohort of journalists who they become familiar with, who are always on their turf at church headquarters. So it just...
Can I explain what you mean by that, Pat? What he said in response to Peggy right after her first question was...
We love Peggy. And I knew
your mom.
Of your grandparents.
Yeah, or something like that. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, and that, you know, look, Mormonism has been for many generations a cultural identity, you know, and a place where people do hold each other in relationship through shared networks and shared family histories. But as, you know, as Janan pointed out, if we're pivoting and we're turning towards this more orthodox, doctrinal rooting down in identity, you know, how long will those relationships keep us in place? You know, was he expressing his affection for Peggy in order to discipline her for asking a challenging question about people of color and LGBTQ people and women? Or was he really welcoming dialogue, or welcoming, you know, welcoming further information, welcoming the perspectives, as Janan put it, out of other people who might look different in that room? Are they aware that that matters to a global membership to see themselves reflected, to have perspectives that could, you know, bring a different inflection even to prayer when you petition God for answers? It matters, your life experience. So anyway, it was discouraging.
We should point out that out of fairness, that he also mentioned to the reporter Dan Rascone that I knew your brother. I mean, these references to reporters
In Texas or something, right?
In Texas, yeah. I thought that was...
Yeah, so, and he can tell he's got a good memory for people and names, and I think that he likes to... I think it's clearly a technique of his to say, to make people feel, you know, loved. Was it appropriate for a press conference? No. Are they used to doing press conferences as church leaders? No. This is yesterday. I just feel like this is dusting off this, you know, maybe this Hinckley era practice of like really engaging, and so they're just not used to this. You could just tell that it wasn't very tactful, but also out of practice.
Let's go back to the phones. Yeah, sorry, go ahead. No, Janan, I wanted to hear you.
Oh no, so I was just to add to what everyone was saying that I completely agree with especially with Joanna's comments and going back to women. He brought President Nelson brought up a very interesting. He tried to quote scripture, and people all over the internet were trying to figure out what scripture is he quoting, and he was looking at DNC 132:63. I don't know if we have time to read it very quickly, but it says, "But if one or either of the 10 virgins, after she is espoused, shall be with another man, she has committed adultery and shall be destroyed. For they are given unto him to multiply and replenish the earth according to my commandment, and to fulfill the promise which was given by my Father before the foundation of the world, and for their exaltation in the eternal worlds, that they may bear the souls of men. For herein is the work of my Father continued, that he may be glorified." And just in the context of the rest of the conference, it just was a slightly uncomfortable comment. I mean, it did tie back to his following comments regarding women's roles and motherhood. It just, like I was saying before, it really solidified what the church's stance will be or is on women.
Back to the phones. Let's take a call from James, is with us in Salt Lake City. James, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine.
So,
how are you?
I have a question, and it's changing the subject a little bit. So I've listened to Radio West for a while, and, you know, I've noticed that the assumption is always that the children of LGBT parents that are not allowed to join the church, I've always had, it always seems that the assumption is that that thing is always anti-LGBT. But when you say in some ways it is for LGBT parents because like it's ensuring that home teachers and local church membership do not go into the homes of LGBT couples and then tell their children that.
James, I'm sorry. I'm gonna jump in. We don't really have time to adjudicate that particular issue right now. Well, just take your point that you've gotten from this program a general sense of negativity related to that policy. I think there have been others who have expressed your opinion, and we're going to move on. I'm sorry. 801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. I did want to – let me take another quick break so we can come back for some final thoughts, because I've sort of blown through these breaks like I'm not supposed to. Lee Hale is with us. KUER is a religion reporter. We have the scholar Joanna Brooks and the scholar Janan Graham Russell. We'll take another break and come back in a quick moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now for some final thoughts. We're talking about the new leadership of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints with Lee Hale, KUER's religion reporter, Joanna Brooks, editor of the forthcoming book, Decolonizing Mormonism, and Janan Graham Russell, a PhD candidate at Harvard University. So there was in October, this was at the 500th anniversary of Martin Luther nailing his theses to the door at the church in Wittenberg, or what we think is that. This woman by the name of Liz wrote her own 95 theses for the present-day Mormon church, and I wanted to talk a little bit about what it is that Mormons want with this new leadership. And it's 95 theses, but she said church is too long. We need a two-hour block. We need it now. Youth leaders need to be trained. We should get rid of this, you know, this weird policy we have about beards being somehow problematic morally. The word of wisdom should be adapted to take into account a cup of coffee not keeping you from certain religious. But she just sort of goes down these lists, and it's fascinating. On one hand, she also says women should be ordained, but a lot of this is really practical stuff too. And Joanna Brooks, I wanted to hear you on that. What are you hearing from rank and file Mormons about the things they want adjusted, adapted in their faith experience?
I mean, certainly all of that. but the fact is, no study has shown that liberalization or, you know, easing cultures of Protestant churches in the U.S. has contributed to retention. There's no data that shows that that's the case. In fact, the opposite. As Protestant churches have liberalized, they've continued to hemorrhage members.
So to stay healthy, you've got to appeal to the core.
LDS sociologists like Armin Maus have talked about an optimal tension that demands can keep people in, keep people engaged. But, I mean, frankly, I don't care about the details if we're not getting the big stuff right. And for a lot of members, it's really hard to get over abandoning the right of all children as taught by Jesus Christ to baptism. Like, that's, you know, whose picture is hanging in the General Conference Assembly Hall matters less to some of us than that.
Janine, what about you? What do you think Mormons are wanting from these new leaders, just on the basics?
I think at the basic level, they just want clarification. I think during Monson's tenure, it was a very dynamic conservative. The church as an entity was dynamic and conservative. And looking forward, I think members are really looking towards a very solid, stable, consistent message. And I think we'll be seeing that from President Nelson.
Stability? That's what we're expecting, do you think?
Possibly. It's hard to get a read. I'm really curious just to be watching how the tone of Nelson's tenure just how it maybe inspires or stops kind of some inspiration at kind of lower levels of the church. You're looking at that list and talking about some of these things. It's interesting looking. There's a lot of Mormon practices people take for granted that did not come from the top. That these start as local things, like the idea of like a young single adult congregation, or the idea of an institute, or the idea of even Sunday school. These are things that some Mormons thought was a good idea. They did it. The church leaders liked it, and they kind of institutionalized it. And we've kind of gone through waves in the Mormon world of leaders who are open to that kind of insight and kind of interpretation from members, and others who it is really top down. And so I wonder if Nelson's going to create an environment where he invites some changes that way, or at least people to kind of make it work a little bit better for themselves.
It's Lee Hale, KUER's religion reporter. Lee, thanks for being with us. Joanna Brooks, a scholar of American religion and culture, editor of the forthcoming book Decolonizing Mormonism. Joanna, good to hear from you. Thanks again.
Thanks, Doug.
And Janann Graham Russell, a PhD candidate at Harvard University, and she's a contributor to books like Mormon Feminism and A Book of Mormons. Janann, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Claire Jones. The program directed by Tim Slover, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.